this terrorist attack on Moscow raised a lot of questions among the experts that they are talking about. It was Ukrainian, it was ISIS. The United States was pushing for the concept that ISIS was behind this terrorist attack. I want to know what's your take on this and how did you find it?
Well, I found it very odd that the United States, in shorter than an hour, within an hour, knew two things. One, it wasn't Ukraine. It wasn't Ukraine. And two, it was ISIS. It was that nebulous sort of entity out there that we call ISIS-K or something like that, you know. How do they know all that stuff within an hour? I don't know. I'm afraid to ask. But doesn't that betray a certain defensiveness, if at the very least? Now, I've looked at what information is available. The key things, of course, are what Putin said in that major address. Excuse me here, I should have gotten rid of that. In the major address the day after the attacks, what he said was, "We got them. We got all four of the perpetrators. They're on their way to Ukraine." Actually, they were within 100 kilometers of Ukraine at the time. And so we know that they were given kind of a window, a little place in Ukraine to come in, and that speaks of contacts. There were arrangements made. And now Putin was typically restrained but strong, saying we're going to find these people and we're going to punish them no matter who was involved. So he didn't blame it on Ukraine right off the bat, but it's pretty clear that what he was saying is, hey, these people were headed for Ukraine. They had contacts, so we're looking into it, and they will. Now, having all four of these folks is going to give them a pretty good window into who orchestrated this thing and hopefully who knew about it. Because if, as seems likely, the Ukrainians orchestrated this thing, it is altogether possible that the British and the American security services knew about it. And if that's the case, and we didn't share that information with the Russians, which they claim we didn't do, that's really as bad as it gets. Because even in the tightest times, even in the most hostile times, security services have passed this kind of information. In one case, I remember very explicitly, from America to Russia, and avoided a terrorist attack, for which Putin publicly thanked the CIA for alerting him. So if they had that information, and this time they didn't give the details that they had, now it could be that they had no details, but at least they had the information, and the Russians are claiming that it was not given to them. The other thing is that I just saw a video clip of Budanov. Now, Budanov is the head of the military intelligence operation, which includes covert action, which includes terrorism. He's been unbashful about admitting the kinds of things that they do, and he's been very proud. Now, he was asked by a BBC interviewer just, I guess, today. I came by chance. Now, how do you feel? How do you feel about what happened? This terrible thing where 133 plus people killed, hundreds so. Yes, I feel very happy about that. Why is that? Well, I just feel very good about that. I think that will be just what is ordered. Do you think that there will be more such attacks? Of course there will. Yes, there will be, even deeper, deeper, deeper into Russia. Oh, thank you very much, Mr. Budanov. Now, Budanov is a really interesting guy. He's a general, but his whole experience is in covert action, in incidents such as happened in Moscow. Besides that, you know, when Victoria Nuland was in Kiev 3 weeks ago, maybe it was a month ago now, and she met with all these folks, right? And she picked who would be the head of the army and who would go as ambassador to London. And he says, Zelensky, Zhaluzhny, and Sirsky, and Budanov. Well, Budanov was slated to become head of the armed forces, but clearly they thought he had a more important job as head of covert action, terrorism, or whatever. So he was left in place. He's a very interesting guy. And he made no bones about his happiness at what happened. Now, when you're happy about 133 teenage kids at a concert being obliterated, they're still peeling skin off the walls of that concert hall, then there's something wrong with you. And when Putin and his investigators learned that Budanov was behind this, perhaps with the cooperation of people like Nuland, I would not sell Budanov any life insurance at all, okay? One last thing. It was very odd when Nuland appeared in Kiev to referee this dispute that was hot and heavy about 5 weeks ago. Really, really bad, you know? Zelensky, Zelensky, you're fired. No, I'm not fired. Yes, you are. No, I'm not. Budanov, you're going to be head of the armed forces. I thought about it. No, I'm not going to. Sirsky, what about you? Okay, yeah, I'll do whatever you want. So Sirsky's given the job. It was bizarre, okay? Now, after all that, after Nuland, who is pretty much the imperial wizard here, she's the director of all this, right? She says, all right, you got it straight now? So Zelensky is still our man, right? You got that? Okay. Zelensky, you go to London after 3 days of a grace period. Sirsky, you're ahead of it. And Budanov, we need you right where we are. After all that, as she's on her way to the airport, she stops outside the premises of the Zelensky compound and does an impromptu interview, amateur one, her staff must have done it, where she say, I just want to say, says Victoria Nuland, that Mr. Putin is going to be in for some nasty surprises on the battlefield pretty soon, okay? Now, who else said nasty surprises for Putin? Well, a fellow named Bogdanov said the same words. So, the Russians are pretty meticulous in investigating these things. As I said, they have the four perpetrators. They should be able to get to the bottom of this without having to gild the lily. And when they do, I think that they're not going to respond in kind. The Russians don't do terrorism, okay? That may sound strange to Americans, but what we can expect from Russia is the kinds of things that they did last night by bombing and destroying one of the huge intelligence installations in Ukraine, and they will just keep on bombing and keep on attriting Ukrainian forces and not be distracted by these things. Meanwhile, they'll make a big case out of what they find in their findings. And, you know, when you look at all this stuff that happens, and when you look at the people that are involved in these escapades, and I have the destruction of the of those pipelines under the Baltic, Nord Stream 1 and 2, also in mind. You know, Putin knows this game. He, I think, was more an analyst than an operator, but you sit together with the operators, you know how this game is played. And I think his idea is that Biden is probably out of the equation here. It may be that Jake Sullivan knows chapter and verse. He, after all, is the guy who runs the intelligence services because he's the national security advisor, and they report to the president through him, through Jacob Sullivan. So they're friends of mine that already put their finger on on Sullivan, saying that it has all the fingerprints of Sullivan, and he's been responsible for things like this. And worse still, from my point of view, and from his, he is probably the intellectual author of Russiagate. He was Hillary Clinton's main campaign advisor. And when she went, really into trouble with those leaked emails from the Democratic National Committee, he figured out, oh, we'll blame it on the Russians. And now it's not only clear to us who saw it from the beginning, but through court documents that always manufactured. It's documentary evidence now. It's testimony under sworn oath that this was all manufactured, first and foremost, by Hillary Clinton's right man, whose name is Jacob Sullivan. The reason I mention that is just to reiterate what I've said before. Sullivan, Blinken, they have a personal stake in this, as does not only Hunter Biden, but his dad. If that other guy wins, that other guy with the red hair, they are in trouble deep. And many, many wars have started on less in terms of personal commitments that have to be protected. So I hope I'm wrong on that, but I think that the Sullivan and Blinken could be responsible for a lot of this, Sullivan in particular, and that if push comes to shove, and it looks like we're suffering a major defeat, that is we, the collective West, NATO, US, Ukraine, in Ukraine, then they might be tempted to go full bore and even use low-yield nuclear weapons just to kind of get the thing stopped until they could have an election in November. Would the American people object to that? My God, I hope they would, but I'm not sure they would, because they are brainwashed into thinking that Putin has two horns, that he's either the devil or Hitler himself reincarnated. So that's the sad thing. The mainstream media has deceived Americans into thinking, and might even persuade most Americans, well, you got to do what you got to do. Russians, if they don't stop in Ukraine, they'll go to Poland and they'll go to the Baltics. And before you know it, they'll be on the English Channel. Americans believe that. It's what the British call bollocks or rubbish, okay? There's no proof of that. And just to finish that thought, how can I be so confident that there's no proof that the Russians don't intend to go take the whole of Ukraine and then take over Poland or the Baltics, okay? I know because there's past precedent for this. Not something I know from 50, 60 years ago. Something I know from 2 years ago. 2 years ago, 6 weeks after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, they stopped. They negotiated with their Ukrainian opposite numbers, first in Belarus and then in Turkey. We have all kinds of confirmation of this. And they reached a deal. Ukrainians decided that, okay, they didn't really need to be a member of NATO. We could talk about Crimea and the Donbass later, but let's stop fighting and let's realize that Ukraine has to be, as its constitution provides, neutral. That was signed, well, initialed, okay, until Zelensky showed it to his American and British colleagues. They put the kibosh on it. Now, how do I know that? Because the lead Ukrainian negotiator has said that chapter and verse, okay? Not been much in the U.S. media, but he negotiated things. That's my initial on that thing. Yeah, they agreed not to become part of NATO. And then the British and the Americans said, no, 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 look, if you buy that thing, we're not going to support you. We're not going to give you lots of money. We're not going to give you lots of weapons. Just stay with us, and we'll stay with you for as long as it takes. Right. So Zelensky made a really bad choice there. He decided that he'd go with us for as long as it takes. And once again, it was clear. This shows the paucity of real reporting. Back in March and April of 2 years ago, 2022, the stories appeared in Ukrainskaya Pravda, okay? The chief Ukrainian newspaper, exactly what happened, that there was a deal initialed and that Boris Johnson in the U.S. said no, and so Zelensky said no, and the war began in earnest, okay? So what am I saying here? I'm saying that, you know, this was not a secret to those of us who follow the basic media, including official Ukrainskaya Pravda, for God's sake. And now it's in testimony from the principal negotiators, namely this fellow that is not a dissident. He's actually head of the faction of Zelensky's party in the parliament there in Kyiv. So Haramia is his name. So I guess it's a long-winded way of saying, I've probably said it before, that my evidence as to whether Putin will stop after he takes Ukraine, you take Poland, the Baltics, and then go to the English Channel. Well, my evidence that that's not true is because 2 years ago, he did stop. Remember? He had surrounded Kyiv pretty much. Most people think that he's met with such resistance that he gave up, and that gave the West a confidence that it shouldn't have had. But he did stop, and he stopped precisely at the time when these agreements were being reached as a goodwill gesture. But you won't find that in any mainstream media in the United States. And therein lies a very, very big problem, Nima, as you know.
We've seen that you, together with other friends of this podcast, you wrote a piece on Consortium News. Your group is called Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. You wrote this piece under the name of The French Road to Nuclear War. You're warning Joe Biden of escalations that can bring a nuclear war to this conflict. And could you elaborate on this article?
Yeah, I think it's rather important. We spent all weekend writing it. 22, I believe, signatories put their John Hancock's under it. What it says is that these reports that Macron, in his delusionary image of himself as Napoleon, perhaps, sort of little guy symptom, I say, that he says, well, you know, we might put 2,000 troops in Ukraine to help the Ukrainian. Now, Scott Ritter, is one of our members, and he took the lead in drafting what is really a very nice, concise memo, which says, okay, now if the French go ahead and do this, what's going to happen to them? Well, the Russians have already said they'll become primary targets, okay? Will they be able to sneak in there? No. Will the Russians know that they're coming in? Yes. Will the Russians destroy them? Yes. Almost certainly, yes. Now, I have to say almost certainly, because Putin has been so restrained and so cautious about these things that it's possible that even though the warning is there, primary targets, they'll let the primary targets mess around there. 2,000 troops is not going to make any difference at all. Okay, so what are the French hoping, or what are the people like the Polish people and the Baltics, what do they think they can achieve by this? Well, we're warning the president, look, we think that once the French troops get attacked, and there's supposed to be some Baltic troops there too, and they will say, hey, wait a second, we're part of NATO. So Article 5 should be invoked. Article 5 says if one country is attacked, all of them have to respond or should respond. So Is that what the game is here? Are the Poles and the Baltics and the French trying to get their camel's nose under the tent here and say, well, we'll put NATO troops in Ukraine. We'll make sure that they get, well, we don't have to make sure. They will get decimated, we think, almost certainly. And then we'll say, well, wait a second. Gate of NATO, now NATO's in. Well, we're telling the president, look, Mr. President, don't fall for that. The best thing you could do would be to announce right off the bat that this is not a NATO operation, that NATO nuclear forces will certainly not be involved in any of this stuff, because as President Obama said way back 9 years ago, 2015, Russia enjoys escalatory dominance in this area. Fancy way of saying, look at the map, for God's sake. Look at the size of the respective countries. Look at the advantage in the military production, artillery, and the rest of it, okay? So if Russia has escalatory dominance here and they obliterate the French, Mr. President, don't get mousetrapped into a war saying NATO has been attacked. The French troops are not part of NATO. Mr. President, the best thing you could do is make clear before they go in there that they're on their own, okay? And when John Kirby, a president's spokesman, talks from the White House, instead of saying, well, every country has a right to decide for themselves what they want to do, what he has to do has been very clear and say, this is not a NATO operation. If the French want to do something that doesn't make sense to us, well, they can do it, but they don't expect our support. Now, when I talk about mousetrapping presidents, I come from the heritage of President John F. Kennedy, who was mousetrapped on that ill-fated Bay of Pigs emigre invasion of Cuba back in 1961, okay? That was just before I joined the agency. What happened was the CIA said, we're going to get Castro. We're going to get Castro. And what we're going to do is we train all these emigres, and they're going to take these little boats, they're going to land on the beach. And as soon as they land on the beach, the Cuban people are going to rise up and throw out this communist dictator. Okay? And Kennedy says, you tell me that this was approved by Eisenhower? And Alan Dulles and the other heads of the CIA says, yeah, I approved it. So you shouldn't have any qualms. So Kennedy very reluctantly approved this cockamamie plan. But what's the big but? He said, look, go ahead, try to do this. But if you run into trouble, if your forces get pinned down on the beach, do not expect any armed forces of America to become involved to rescue you. Got that? Got that? Say that after me. No U.S. military forces to bail you out. Oh, got it. Okay. So as people predicted, they get pinned down on the beach. And Alan Dulles and all the Joint Chiefs of Staff were up in arms. Said, Mr. President, you got to come in now, for God's sake. And Kennedy said, you remember what I told you guys? No. The answer is no. And so they all got captured, hundreds of them. It was a fiasco, okay? Worse still, this business about the Cubans all rising and overthrowing Castro, that was made up out of whole cloth. Guess what? The operations part of the agency, of the CIA, running this operation, never checked with the people who were experts on Cuba, the analysts, the division where I worked. They never even told them about the operation, much less said, do you agree that the Cubans will rise up? And then, because they would have been told, oh, no, Castro is very, very popular, almost as popular as Putin is now in Russia. Okay, that's not going to happen. So they deceived the president on two counts, on that key thing about Castro being overthrown. And the other thing, they knew damn well. Now, yeah, I'm not making this up. When Alan Dulles died, on his desk were coffee-stained notes in his own hand. And one of those notes said, when President Kennedy realizes that we need support from the armed forces of America, he will not be able to deny that support, because otherwise he will realize that the enterprise will fail, period, end quote. The enterprise, overthrow Castro. So what I'm saying here is that presidents can be manipulated, they can be deceived, they can be mousetrapped into things that they really don't want to do, okay? And we can see that that can apply today. And it's very disquieting that that this would be so operative today with Biden reluctant to start World War III, but equally reluctant to bear the consequences of losing the election, much less the war. So what would be his preference? Well, I don't know. These personalities play a big role in such decisions. And that sort of reminded me, as I thought through what's going on now, the parallels of the past. Well, I think as I've said before, or quoted before, history doesn't always repeat itself, but it rhymes. And I think that this is a rhyming sound I'm hearing in my ears about this calculation.
What's your take on the fate of the small Baltic states, Finland, Sweden, and these countries that survived the Cold War, and now they're getting involved in this escalation between the West and Russia? How do you find the future of these states?
Well, you know, Nima, it's really hard to be a psychiatrist and figure out what motivates the leaders of these countries. But there is a lowest common denominator, I would suggest, and that they're a bunch of political hacks that know nothing of history. Finland, for example, for God's sake, a prosperous nation living right next to Russia. They worked it out after the war when Finland first fought with the Nazis, right? Okay, were beaten back. They had a friendly relation, but it's just not just a peaceful relation, a friendly relation with Russia, and lots of mutual benefits for trade and everything else across the border. That's all gone now. Why? Have the Finns been persuaded that the Russians are going to take over Finland? Putin always says, почему? Почему? За что? За что? Why? Why? For what reason would we want to do that? I don't know. You know, maybe Stalin would have, maybe the old Soviet regime would have, but what's the indication that today's Russia wants to do that? So it's either a complete lack of history and being political hacks, or it's not an either or. It's also, there are military manufacturers in all these countries, especially in Sweden, that are making a pile of dough on building and selling arms. It's called the military industrial complex. I call it, if you have a pencil, you might take this down, Mickey Matt. Okay, sort of rhymes with Mickey Mouse. It's the military industrial congressional intelligence media academia think tank complex, Mickey Matt. Everything is sort of funded by the government that gets the government people are funded by the people profiteering on arms. One example would be, here's a good one, I think. In Germany, there was a big arms manufacturing concern called Maffei. And they were in league with a French partner, and they were going to build the common European battle tank. Formidable thing, right? Okay. And in the early 90s, when the Soviet Union fell apart, it was the worst thing that could have happened to them because there was no enemy and they couldn't get anybody interested in building the common European battle tank until 2014, when the West staged that coup d'etat in Kiev, and Russia was all of a sudden a palpable, menacing enemy. Oh, my fight! Stock goes up. All the people's stock goes up. And they build these things that are not quite as resilient or adaptable to the kind of conflict that has been going on in Ukraine as the Russian opposite numbers. So it's a as I see it, and who knows, it depends on which ruler is so disorganized or so bereft of any historical sense. But the military industrial complex is always a major factor in Europe as well as in our country. You know, I think I have cited before one time where it became, well, where hypocrisy was given a really bad name, so to speak, when the Pope came to Congress, 2015, I think it was. And he said, you know, the real problem in the world is the blood-soaked arms trade. Now, giving hypocrisy a bad name, Congress people and senators get up and cheered wildly. Oh, yeah, Pope, you're right about that, Pope. And then they look into their pockets to see if the latest envelope from Lockheed was there, and over here, the one from Raytheon. It was really quite remarkable because these people get funded by these arms making and arms trading companies. And then they appropriate money to build more arms, and then some of that profit comes back to the companies, of course, and back into the pockets of the politicians. They get reelected and they appropriate more money. I mean, it's a really nice little circular thing, isn't it? That's what's happened in our country. And there are lots of people, not lots of people, 1% are sitting high, while the rest of our country, not sitting very high. Almost record numbers of people in poverty these days, where there is actually no reason for it. And we faced with a choice of two possible candidates whose record shows they don't care much about people in poverty.